So how could Alan possibly scorch out a marathon in 2 hours and 40 minutes immediately after swimming nearly 2.5 miles and biking 112? There was only one explanation. I knew that he had to start the race without any sugar or glycogen in his muscles, Noakes would say. So he must have just been burning fat. Phil Maffetone knew this years ago, Noakes concluded. Fat as fuel. It's exactly what he was saying all the way back in the 80s. Imagine the difference if we just listened to him. Or knew where he was. Chapter 34. Then they cut slices from the thighs, wrapped them in layers of fat, and laid raw meat on top, while the young men stood by, five-pronged forks in their hands. Homer, the Iliad. For a man who'd spent years on the speed dial of athletes and rock stars, Phil Maffetone knows how to make himself scarce. The only online presence for a person by that name, when I went looking for him, was a bare-bones webpage, a placeholder for some singer-songwriter that provided no contact info or any mention of medical or athletic work. But in an old paperback, long out of print, I came across a lead. Back in the 80s, Maffetone published a slim manual called In Fitness and in Health. Inside, I spotted a name I recognized, Hal Walter, a pro burro racer I'd met in Colorado during an annual ultramarathon, in which athletes run up and down a mountain alongside a pack burro. Prize money on the burro racing circuit is pretty lean, so in the off-season, Hal was a freelance editor and outdoors writer. That's how he met Phil Maffetone. In exchange for edits, Hal got fat as fuel training. Whatever tips Maffetone gave him must have been gold. Hal won his 7th world championship in 15 years at age 53 and could still average 7 minutes per mile for 30 miles at 13,000 feet. During races that can last 5 or more hours, he only sips water. I contacted Hal, who agreed to pass my message along to Maffetone. A week or so later, I received an email from PM. No name, just the 2 lowercase letters. If I was interested in talking, PM said, I should come to Oracle, Arizona. Our home isn't that easy to find. Call when you get close and I'll talk you in. If your cell phone works, don't count on it. So I was off to Oracle, a lonely desert outpost best known for UFO sightings and the occasional underground meth lab. Not far away is Biosphere 2, a self-contained environmental experiment constructed there deliberately to avoid being noticed by, basically, anyone. Edward Abbey had the same idea. Decades ago, the irascible writer and echo warrior began using Oracle as his mailing address, so no one would know where he was. Geographically and psychologically, Oracle is out there. I followed PM's directions, crossing an old railroad track and rumbling down a dusty red dirt road until I pulled up at a pleasant little cottage ringed by an artful garden of desert plants. Chickens scratched in the side yard, then scattered behind the cacti when the door opened and a lean, handsome man with a snow-white ponytail stepped out. Was I really that hard to find? Maffetone asked. You mean the drive? Not so bad, but the rest? Maffetone shrugged and led me inside to meet his wife, Dr. Coralie Thompson, a physician who for 15 years was medical director at Philadelphia's Institutes for the Achievement of Human Potential. People seem to think I just went up in smoke like a genie. In Maffetone's eyes, his sudden transformation from Dr. Iron Man into Invisi Phil was a logical step. Fat as fuel was an intellectual challenge, and once he'd solved it, neatly, effectively, solid as a mathematical proof, it was on to the next endeavor. I've had original music in my head since I was 3 years old, he says. It was time to do something about it. So he shuttered his practice, referred his clients, rented his New York home, and rambled across the country until he found a place where he wouldn't be disturbed or tempted back into endurance sports. Which, he's too polite to say, is exactly what I'm doing. The whole reason he settled out here, alone with Coyote Howls and Coralie and the guitar Johnny Cash gave him, was specifically to avoid people like me. But when he saw my message, he was intrigued. Once Maffetone understood what I was up to, he spotted a connection I'd missed. I'd been wondering whether Paddy and Chan and their Cretan accomplices could have survived their long adventures through the mountains because they'd learned to tap into fat as fuel. But Maffetone realized something else. "Do you know the healthiest diet in the world?" he asked. "The Mediterranean?" "Right. Do you know where it's from?" "Greece?" "Close," he said. "Crete." Crete was both the strangest and most enduring result of Ansel Keys' seven-country study. Keys' goal was to pin down the lifestyle causes of heart attacks and strokes, so for 12 years, from 1958 to 1970, his team gathered biological markers from men aged 40 to 59 in Italy, Japan, Yugoslavia, Finland, Holland, America, and Greece. It really was a noble experiment. In his own way, Keyes was trying to save millions of lives by demonstrating that cardiovascular disease was an active choice, not an act of God. No one disputes the data Keyes collected. They just argue that he should have included regions that didn't necessarily fall in line with his saturated fat is fatal theory. For Greece, Keyes took most of his subjects from Crete. It was a rare opportunity to travel back in time, because life in those mountain villages hadn't changed in 300 years. Cretan farmers were still living like their ancestors. They used the same rough tools, ate the same foods, slept in the same huts, and raised sheep descended from the same family flock. If Keyes was right, and heart attacks were the result of a decadent modern lifestyle, then these middle-aged throwbacks should be fantastically healthy. And they were, except for one weird twist. The Cretans had the lowest rate of heart disease in the entire study, yet their serum cholesterol was high, and they ate a ton of fat, more than any other country in the study. Nearly half of the calories that went down a Cretan's throat came from fat. Going by Keyes's model, heart disease should have been all over those mountains. Instead, the Cretans lived long and stayed strong. So why were Cretans more heart healthy than everyone else, including the Japanese, who consumed only a quarter as much fat? The secret was partly what they ate: meat, butter, fish, olive oil, wild greens and walnuts. But mostly what they didn't: sugar and starch. Unlike the rest of the industrialized world, Crete wasn't jolted by World War II into a new way of eating. Much of post-war Europe and Asia desperately needed aid, so cattle and dairy farms were repurposed to raise grain. In a pinch, bread and porridge could fill more bellies and wouldn't spoil in transit. 20 years before Keyes showed up with his research team, Finland had already begun converting grazing pasture into wheat fields and rows of sugar beets, which were processed into an all-purpose additive akin to high-fructose corn syrup. During the Great Depression of the 1930s, a Finnish economic analysis noted, the government encouraged farmers to shift from exportable animal products to basic grains, a policy that kept farm incomes from falling as rapidly as they did elsewhere and enabled the country to feed itself better. One result? More Finns died of heart disease than anyone else in the seven-country study. Prosperity was its own peril in the United States. Giant factories constructed to feed the troops were now turning their attention to the family home, using wartime technologies to churn out canned soups, easy-grab snacks, and packaged bread. Orange juice, an exotic treat before the war, was suddenly everywhere, Military contractors had figured out how to make frozen concentrate. And as soon as growers realized it could be sold as a health food, orange juice production skyrocketed from barely a quarter million gallons a year to more than 115 million. 3 out of every 4 Americans soon had OJ in the freezer, right next to another new sensation, frozen TV dinners, pre-packaged with plenty of sugar, salt, and hydrogenated vegetable oil. In 1951, Kellogg's rolled out its twin juggernauts, sugar frosted flakes and sugar pops, then removed even the need for milk by inventing Pop-Tarts. The great American breakfast of bacon and eggs was becoming a dinosaur, along with home-cooked dinners, locally baked bread, and backyard gardens. Sucrose, fructose, corn syrup, and bleached white flour, the difference between dinner and dessert, had disappeared. But up in the mountains of Crete, nothing had changed. Most villages were self-sustaining and barely reachable by road, so they remained untouched by the flood of starch and sugars engulfing the rest of the world. The Cretans kept foraging for wild plants, baking rough millet into loaves as chewy as jerky, frying free-range eggs in home-pressed olive oil, and eating every part of the sheep but the bar. Potatoes were rare in the Rocky Highlands. Rice was unheard of. Pastries were an occasional indulgence, and nearly as jaw-breaking as the bread. The Cretans, in other words, were eating the same high-performance food as their Olympic athlete ancestors. Like this, Phil Maffetone said as we sat down with Coralie for lunch. They'd prepared steak, sliced thin and blood-rare, alongside a jumbled salad of torn greens, tomatoes, cucumbers, and homemade goat milk feta, glistening with olive oil and sprinkled with fresh aromatic herbs. Break it down to raw components, and it's the same food that Paddy and Chan survived on during their time in the caves. All slow burn, all the time. Those resistance fighters couldn't have gotten their calories from starch and sugar, because it just wasn't available, Maffetone explains. If they could only eat on the run, they needed food that would provide steady caloric energy all day. Greek battlefields didn't have Gatorade stations. Fugitives couldn't detour in search of snacks. Survival depended on 2 things. Choosing slow-burn food and adapting your body to use it. Maffetone was very late figuring this out, of course, at least compared with Pythagoras. The pioneering mathematician also had a side interest in sports science, and after he settled in Croton in the 6th century BC, the city suddenly began churning out champions. At one games, Croton swept the top 7 places in the 200-yard stadium race, while winning both the boxing and wrestling crowns. Pythagoras's son-in-law, Milo of Croton, became ferocious enough in hand-to-hand combat to lead the annihilation of the kingdom of Sybaris and skillful enough in wrestling to rack up more victories than any other Olympian, a total of 31 victories over a 24-year career. And what contributed to their success? Pythagoras experimented with a special meat diet, it's reported, which was so effective that historians have battled for centuries over who deserves credit. Pausanias says it was Dromaeus, the runner, who proved true to his name and dominated the distance events at 4 games after he conceived the idea of a flesh diet. A rival school says Pythagoras got there first. His student Milo was famous for his meat consumption half a century before Dromaeus is supposed to have discovered its efficacy in building up champion athletes. Ancient Greek trainers became so sophisticated in the nuances of slow-burn fueling that they could split hairs over the relative merits of deep-sea versus inshore fish based on what type of seaweed they would likely have eaten. On pork, there was no dissent. They all agreed you wanted to steer clear of pigs who'd forage for crabs along the riverbanks and stick to the ones who fed on acorns and cornel berries. But here's where the story gets strange. Milo retired. Pythagoras got into a political jam and moved away. And just like that, Croton was finished. No more sprinting laurels, No more Titanic fighters. Whatever Croton was doing right, it wasn't doing it anymore. There's no record of Croton ever winning another title at the Games. The city didn't suddenly run out of strong young men or acorn-fattened ham, but whatever the magic was, it was gone. Food is only half the equation, Mafferton explains. You can have the finest fuel in the world, but it's useless without the proper engine. It's two systems. It's input, what you eat, and output, how it's converted. But here's the funny part. It's really, really simple. For anyone or just seasoned athletes? Anyone. How long does it take to learn? 2 weeks. 2 weeks and you can master it. 2 weeks and you'll be running on fat like your resistance fighters. I pushed my notebook toward him across the table. Mafferton began scrawling notes. To give him time, I got up to help clear the table. Maybe I'd take a walk with Coralie until... Here you are. He couldn't have written more than a dozen sentences. I sat back down and started to read. Really? It's that easy? Phil picked up the guitar and played me some of his songs. When it started getting late, Coralie packed me some of her special fattest fuel snacks for the road. Then I was heading home to see what the Mafferton method could really do. Step 1. The 2-week test. Mafferton underlined test in my notebook to make sure I got the point. This is emphatically not a diet. Diets, he believes, are a joke. They're based on a stupid, shame-based notion that losing weight is a matter of willpower and sacrifice, that you're heavy only because you're too lazy to starve yourself down to size. It's baffling anyone still believes that, but they do, Mafferton told me, even when it's so clearly, visibly unnatural. Humans are hunter-gatherers. We're born to search for food all day, every day, and scarf it down once we find it. Going hungry is the opposite of everything we've evolved to do. So eat all you want, Mafferton urges. Just reboot your belly so it craves the food we've always hunted and gathered, not the fake stuff we've come to rely on. Once you've detoxed from the starch cycle and brought your body back to its natural metabolism, he says, you'll be free of hunger pangs and afternoon sugar crashes and midnight munchies. It only takes 14 days, as long as you follow one rule of thumb. Nothing high glycemic. Nothing that jacks your blood sugar, in other words, and causes insulin to start storing fat. By the end of 2 weeks, I should be a fresh slate, glycemically speaking, and no longer cycling from sugar surge to sugar surge. Then, once the test is over, I can gradually add processed carbs back to my meals and see what happens. If I eat a slice of bread and feel fine, okay. But if it makes me feel bloated, sluggish, or sleepy, I'll know it's too much starch for my body to metabolize efficiently. That's what the 2-week test is all about. It's designed to reactivate your natural diagnostic panel, so that instead of relying on some diet book to tell you what to eat, you'll get instant, accurate feedback from your own body. You'll actually know what it feels like to have normal insulin levels and optimal blood sugar, Mafferton explains. So when I get home, I go shopping. I fill the cart with steak, fish, broccoli, avocados, canned squid, tuna, tomato juice, romaine lettuce, sour cream, and cashews. Tubs of cashews, because they'll be my go-to temptation snuffer. Also on the yes list, eggs, cheese, whole cream, dry white wine, scotch, and salsa. But no fruit, breads, rice, potatoes, pasta, or honey. No beans, which means no tofu or soy of any stripe. No chips, no beer, no milk or yogurt. No deli ham or roast beef either, since they're often cured in sugar. Turkey was fine if you cooked it yourself, but even then, you have to be careful. I thought I'd hit the perfect multi-meal solution when I came across a stack of small butterballs in the frozen food section, And only as an afterthought did I check the label and discover they were sugar-injected. Garbanzos are pretty moderate glycemically, I emailed Maffetone after I'd done a little research on my own. So I'd like to lobby for hummus. Rule number one of step number one, he replied. No lobbying. The trick, I soon discovered, is solving one meal at a time. Breakfast was easy. By some whim, I discovered that those $1.98 cans of squid from the Mexican food aisle are great in an omelette. So I'd fry up one of those, douse it with salsa, and be a happy man the rest of the morning. I kept cashews and spicy meat sticks on hand throughout the day as snacks, and learned to add a splash of whole cream to my coffee instead of half and half. Lunch and dinner were only borderline crises when I got distracted and let myself get ravenous before planning what to eat. By the end of day two, I felt like I had things under control. And then I stepped outside. Step two, the 180 formula. I was barely a half mile into an easy run and whoa, why was my head spinning? I walked it off and began trotting again, but after another half mile, I was bone-weary and panting. I wasn't tired, exactly. Whenever I stopped running, I felt strong and rested and ready to go, but as soon as I began to push a little, my energy drained, and that damn beeping started all over again. For step two, Maffetone had me wearing a runner's heart rate monitor, a basic model with a chest strap and wristwatch console. The alarm was set to go off just before I hit my fat-burning threshold, which I'd calculated according to Maffetone's quick and easy equation. To figure out your fat-burning zone, you subtract your age from 180 and then fine-tune by this scale. A. If you've been sidelined for a while with injury or illness, subtract another 5. B. If you've been sidelined a long time, like recovering from a heart attack, subtract 10. C. If you've been training at least 4 times a week for 2 years, add 0. D. If you've trained hard for 2 years and are progressing in competition, add 5. In my case, it works like this. I'm 50 years old, so 180 minus 50 equals 130. I run regularly and haven't been injured, putting me in category C, no additional points. So, my fat-burning threshold is 130 heartbeats per minute. That means I can work out as long, as fast, and as strenuously as I please, but whenever my heart rate hits 130, and my wrist alarm starts beeping, I have to ease off until my pulse drops back below the threshold. Maffetone believes your body is content to burn fat as long as it's not being pushed into oxygen debt. When you need more air, your heart begins to hammer. When your heart is pounding fast, it demands fast-burn fuel. So to wean yourself off sugar, you have to change both supply and demand. You cut the sugar from your diet and keep your pulse within your fat-burning zone. Maffetone hit on the formula because of a happy accident. Heart rates can be as low as 30 to 40 in those with great aerobic function, to as high as 220 or higher in young athletes during all-out efforts, Maffetone explained. Using those numbers as his range, he originally put clients through extensive physiological tests to determine precisely when their metabolism kicked over from fat to sugar. After a few years of playing with the numbers, he realized he could just subtract their age from 180 and get the same results as if he'd done the testing. Why the math works, Maffetone can't say. It just does. 180 minus age itself is not a meaningful number, he explained. It is not associated with VO2 max, lactate threshold, or other traditional measurements. It's just a shortcut to the end number, your maximum aerobic heart rate. Maffetone was delighted because the magic equation allowed him to stop being the middleman between the athletes and their bodies. Maffetone believes the more you understand your own internal signals and stop listening to other people, even to him, the healthier you'll be. That was the beauty of the 180. It was so simple. Anyone willing to invest $50 in a heart rate monitor could be their own sports science lab. Maffetone has tested it on hundreds of athletes, including triathlon legends like Mike Pigg and Mark Allen, and they've consistently come back with the same results. They recover faster from workouts, blow past their old records in competition, and leave chronic injuries behind. One reason they rarely get hurt is that they're no longer gritting through fatigue. When you go into oxygen debt, your form crumbles, your head drops, your feet thump, your knees go cockeyed. You get sloppy, and you pay for it. It was obvious that training at various intensities affected both posture and gait, Maffetone explained. The more anaerobic, the more distortion of the body's mechanics. But if you're always going slow, I'd asked, how do you ever get fast? You work your way up a few heartbeats at a time. You adapt. The more workouts you do in the fat-burning zone, the easier they get. The easier they get, the faster you can go. Maffetone predicted my workouts would feel ridiculously slow for the first few weeks. If you're used to running 8 minutes a mile, he said, you might have to throttle back to 10 and walk the hills to stop your heart rate alarm from beeping. But you'll become so good at running 10-minute miles, he promised, you'll eventually be able to trot up any hill without breaking the 130-beat barrier. Before long, I should be able to run faster and farther than ever without hitting my heart rate threshold or running low on fuel. Oh, and another thing, Maffetone added. Don't be surprised if you feel a little bit, awful. When your body is denied its sugar supply, it can get grouchy. Ugh, I saw what he meant about 4 minutes into the first run. Fatigue kept washing in and out like waves. I'd be clipping along easily, then suddenly feel like I was coming down with a flu. It would pass after a few minutes of woozy walking, only to come roaring back shortly after I started running again. It was the eeriest sensation, like being yanked back and forth by a tug of war inside my own digestive system. We need sugar. Shut your pie hole, we're fine. Onward! Maffetone had warned me to expect this, though, so I trudged on home and braced for a rough few days ahead. Instead, I was greeted on the next morning's run by a pleasant surprise. Instead of head spins, I got beeping. My heart rate monitor began to chirp while I was a few hundred yards up an easy climb, and it dawned on me that I hadn't gotten dizzy yet. The storm had passed. It was as if my body had given up the fight and surrendered the secret fuel stash it was hoarding. Now my challenge was keeping the damn wrist alarm quiet. Every time I got into a groove and started to leg it out a little, beep, beep, beep. Hills were the worst. I tried taking long, deep belly breaths in hopes of Zen mastering my pulse down a few blips, but it didn't help much. I spent that whole day, and the next, creaking along like a cyclist in granny gear. At least Dutch skaters were going through the same thing. Back in the early 90s, the Dutch national speed skating team also began experimenting with low heart rate training. It was a valiant quest, because as much as the Dutch loved their skating, they were still up against ever more daunting powerhouses like the United States, Norway, and Canada. But despite the stiffening competition, the Dutch eased back. They replaced hard workouts with easier ones. In the 70s, 80% of their workouts were high intensity. That total dwindled to 50% in 1992 and just 30% by 2010. It wasn't as if they were putting in more ice time either. We first hypothesized that the total amount of training hours would have been increased over the years. Our analyses showed that this was not the case, a research team concluded in 2014, after analyzing 38 years of Dutch training logs. Surprisingly, there was no increase in net training hours, the researchers added, while performance increased considerably. Considerably. Now that's a gentle way to put it. The Dutch destroyed. At the 2014 Winter Olympics, Dutch skaters crushed the field so relentlessly, on-air commentators complained it was bad for the sport. Together, Dutch men and women came home with 23 of 36 possible medals. Never in the history of the Games has one nation won so many gold medals in a single event. The domination of their speed skating athletes has been total, with traditional rivals such as the USA, Canada and Norway utterly humiliated, the British Guardian summed it up. The Dutch secret was as old as the Games themselves. The key to going fast, the Greeks believed, was a long time going slow. They called it fatigue work, and until an ancient Greek athlete was 20 years old, he did little else. Fatigue work was raw, Rocky IV-style stuff. Hiking mountains, carrying a heavy rock up and down a hill, climbing a rope slung over a tree branch, and the ek plethrisma, running back and forth across the 100-foot plethron, taking one step less every lap until you reach zero. The godfather of fatigue work, of course, was Milo of Croton. He came up with the idea of hoisting a newborn calf over his shoulders and carrying it around the stadium every day, gradually getting stronger as the heifer got bigger. On the last day of my 2-week test, I tried a Milo of Croton experiment of my own. It was time to tally the results of my maffetone immersion, which for me really boiled down to one question. Was fat as fuel for real? Was it easy, sustainable, and effective? If by now I couldn't do more on less food, and find that food easily and eat it on the fly, then Maffetone's approach didn't explain how Paddy and Chan and their Cretan brothers-in-arms got stronger as life got harder. Already I knew that in 2 out of 3 categories, Maffetone was scoring high. I'd lost 11 pounds in those 2 weeks, trimming me back to the same weight I'd been as a college rower nearly 30 years ago. I felt more like that teenage athlete again, too. Not just skinnier, but springier, more revved and rested. One afternoon I was about to head out for a run and suddenly remembered I'd done an hour-long Erewhon-style workout that morning. I'd recovered so thoroughly, I felt fresh enough already to do it all over again. So I did. Even more surprising was the change that came over food. Good old standbys like pizza, cheesesteaks, and donuts now seemed untempting and kind of gross. Soon I'd be allowed to ease them back into my meals, but it was hard to imagine why I'd want to. The final exam, though, was out there on the hill, the same place that made me woozy the first day and kept my heart rate monitor beeping the next 5. Since then, I'd stayed away. It was too aggravating. Even when I thought I'd adapted enough to glide to the top, the alarm always buzz-killed me down to a walk before I made it halfway. On this last day, though, I hit it just right. I warmed up on the approach and then backed off, easing into the climb. When I sensed I was passing the spot where I'd maxed out the first day, I didn't even turn my head to check. I kept eyes straight and everything else loose, trying to roll up and over this thing with my pulse slow thumping in the fat-burning zone. Over and over in my mind, I looped the words of a wise old friend. First focus on easy, Micah True used to say, because if that's all you get, that ain't so bad. Halfway came and went without a beep, and I knew I had it. Why not? If Milo could work his way up to a 1,000-pound ball, I should be able to handle a half-mile hill. The top was just steps away. I just had to remember to beep, beep, beep. Breathe. Breathe, you idiot. So close. And I blew it by getting anxious and holding my breath. Still, if I could get that far on just 14 days of adapting to fat as fuel, there was no telling how far I could get after a few months. Probably up and over the tallest mountain on Crete. Chapter 35. If you really attack a fire, you put it out. But if you attack it cautiously and fearfully, you get burned. Greek philosopher Dio Chrysostom, the Golden-Tongued. I wasn't counting on snow, though. It was early May, the same time of year that Paddy was on the run, when Chris White and I began tracking his escape route. Springtime on Crete is like high summer anywhere else, so we'd spent the first few days sweating under a blazing sun. It was so hot as we crossed the Lassiti Range that when we stumbled across a natural spring trickling into a stone sheep trough, we tore off our clothes and plunged in for a naked soak. For the rest of the day, we kept one eye on the trail and the other scanning for more heaven-sent plunge pools. Mount Ida was a different story. At daybreak, we stood at its base and realized that high overhead, the gorge leading to the peak was still choked with snow. There was no getting around it. The only way Chris and I could cross the mountain would be to drop into that gully and hope the snowpack was solid enough to hold our weight as we crunched our way up to the top. If we were going to try, we had to go now. The higher the sun rose, the deeper we'd sink if we crashed through the crust. "How high are we looking?" I asked Chris. "High," he said. "Nearly 3,000 meters." Chris glanced over his shoulder at the sun cresting the peaks behind us. We were starting at nearly sea level, so we had a long vertical ascent ahead before sunset. "Shall we?" We shouldered our packs and began climbing, sidestepping through a long wash of crumbly scree as we traversed in an uphill diagonal toward the gorge. We were still on stone when the pitch suddenly veered upward, steepening so aggressively that I had to press my chest into the rock and climb with my hands to keep my pack from pulling me over backwards. The footing was so thin and crumbly, it was a relief 2 hours later to finally reach that long finger of snowpack. We dropped into the gorge and were delighted. "It's frozen, easy walking," until we crashed through and sank up to our hips. The only way out was belly first. We clawed with our hands until we pulled ourselves far enough out to free our legs a little. Then, lying flat on the snow, we kicked and swam until we got ourselves back out and up on our feet, only to drop back in a few steps later. We floundered along, mastodons in a tar pit, until we hit a steep stretch frozen into a glassy sheet. This was even trickier. If we lost our footing, we'd slide backwards and rocket all the way down the slope until we crashed to a stop on the rocks. I was glad to have a few months of Erwan training under my belt to fall back on, but as usual, Chris knew what to do instinctively. He dropped to all fours, and I copied him, kicking in with my toes and gripping as best I could with my hands as we inched along. "Now," Chris panted, "try this in the dark." When Paddy and Billy eyed Mount Ida from the mouth of their cave, the sun worried them more than the snow. There was no way they could get the general across the mountain in a single night, which meant that no matter what time they started, at some point dawn would break and they'd be stuck out there in full daylight. The worst place was high above treeline. The shaved scalp, as Billy called it, where they'd have nowhere to hide from planes and nowhere to run from pursuers. So they dashed for it. After a recon plane passed in mid-afternoon, Paddy and his band slipped out of the cave and went on the move. They'd attack the lower slope immediately, then duck for cover before the planes circled back at dusk. They'd wait for the high roar of the engines to fade away, then set off again, crossing the snow in the dark, before making the last hard push off the mountain before dawn. It was a gamble, especially because the general would be on his own 2 feet. The steepness and irregularity of the track were too much for the mule, Paddy observed. Back it had to go, and the general, to his despair and ours, had to continue on foot up a slippery and collapsing staircase of loose boulders and shale and scree. But if they timed it right, it was their best chance to stay alive. Waiting for Paddy at the foot of the mountain were the 5 Georges, 5 shepherds, all named George, who'd been sent by the local rebel leader as guides and bodyguards. The Georges quickly fanned out, some taking point while others trailed behind to keep an eye on the prisoner. They led Paddy's band along spidery goat paths, zigzagging them up the steep stone until, just before dark, they reached Snowline. The last stunted mountain cedar vanished, leaving us in a stricken world where nothing grew and a freezing wind threatened to blow us off our feet. Then deep snow turned every step into torment. Paddy would say. Mist surrounded us, and rain began to fall. We stumbled on, bent almost double against the blast. No breath or energy was left, even for objurgation. Frozen and soaked to the skin, they fought through the snow at 8,000 feet, desperate for a warm sun, but doomed if it came up. Paddy's plan, they all knew, had failed. They'd never make it off that mountain before dawn. So, shortly before sunrise, the 5 Georges improvised a plan B. The Georges led the band to an old shepherd's hut, a tumble-down stone ruin with a collapsed roof that would give them a little shelter from the wind, but not enough to draw attention. From the air, it would look like a pile of rubble and conceal them enough to wait for night to fall again. Paddy and Billy slunk back outside on a quick forage, hunting among the icy rocks, until they spotted those familiar grey-leafed weeds. "Mountain dandelions," explained Billy, who'd grown to savour their pleasant, bitter taste. The 2 Brits brought breakfast back to the hut, where they found the 5 Georges muttering and glaring at the general. "I think he must have sensed the atmosphere of antagonism," Billy observed, "for he kept very quiet and sat by himself in a corner, not speaking." "You've got a pistol," the Georges told Paddy. "Use it." The general was dragging his heels on purpose, they suspected. He knew they were vulnerable on the mountain, so he was playing a waiting game, dawdling along to keep them up there as long as he could. The Georges weren't going to be captured because Paddy was a nice guy. It was time to put a gun to the general's head and give him a choice. Move or die. "You're right," Paddy agreed. "But that will only work once. We need to reserve it as a last resort." Which, it turned out, was just a few hours away. At nightfall, the band slipped out of the hut and began their descent. Going down, Billy soon discovered, was scarier than going up. The moon faded behind clouds, forcing them to grope their way blindly. If any one of them fell, he could 10-pin the rest of the group and send them on a long slide into the teeth of a boulder field. "It took us 2 hours to reach the bottom of the snow belt," Billy said. "And then it got worse." "The mountain steepened to the tilt of a ladder," Paddy would recall. "It was channeled and slippery with rain, and each footfall unloosed a landslide of shifting stones. We were descending, hand over hand, through what seemed, in the dark and the wind, to be a jungle of hindering branches, spiked leaves, and vindictive twigs." Every step was an act of faith. If the Georges accidentally led them off a dead drop, Paddy and Billy wouldn't know until they were falling through the air. Below, the rebels were supposed to signal all's clear by lighting fires. Paddy and his band strained their eyes, searching the distance for pinpoints of flame, as Billy had to ask himself the only question that really mattered. Why? Why were they still pushing toward the coast when the only ones who knew they were heading that way were the Germans? Did the British even know they were alive? How could they, when the one man they were counting on to coordinate their escape was still missing? There was still no word about Tom Dunbabin's mysterious disappearance, and Paddy's attempts to improvise backup communication to Cairo were becoming deadly. A Cretan runner carrying a message to a wireless operator on the far side of the mountain was intercepted by Germans and shot to death, while two others barely got away.
"They brought us ugly news," the rebel fighter Scuttle George would recall. "The Germans were hunting along the coast and up all the valleys. It was hopeless to go there. They also said it would be impossible for the English ship we were waiting for to approach the shore."
What was the point, then? Why cross this mountain when they had no idea if a boat could ever meet them on the other side? But if the five Georges felt any doubt, it wasn't slowing them down. They flowed down the backside of Mount Ida, sure-stepping along crumbling trails no wider than their feet, and pivoting around boulders that suddenly loomed ahead in the dark. Keeping Billy and Paddy alive was the test of a true heros, a true protector. And there was only one way to pull it off, the Cretan way. They'd been raised to run farther, adapt faster, and survive on less than the men trying to kill them. All they had to do was find a donkey for the general, and they could stay on the move and fade back into the wilderness. But first, they had to get off that mountain. From the top of Mount Ida, Chris White and I looked down and considered our options. Off trail, there was a skinny snake of a route that was somehow free of snow, but parts of it were too steep to walk, and the rest was a crazy obstacle course of boulders and scree patches and sudden mini-cliffs where rocks had sheared from the mountain face. Or we could stick to the wandering thread of switchbacks, except they were so cross-hatched by snowpack that we'd constantly be sidestepping on a 45-degree angle across frozen sliding boards. "I've got an idea," I called over to Chris. "But you might hate it."
"I hate this," he said, kicking at the ice.
"What have you got?" I told him about parkour and my apprenticeship in drugstore parking lots and London housing projects. I filled him in on the way Shirley bounded over walls and the fact that the Yamakaze believed elastic recoil was the secret of effortless movement in the new urban jungle. I'd even asked Dan Edwards specifically about Crete, and he wasn't surprised that newcomers like Chan and Paddy and Billy Moss could learn to adapt. "The same thing we do in the city, they do in mountain terrain," Dan had said. "That Cretan bounce you were asking about, that comes from precision. When you hit a rock and bounce off, it's because you hit it square. You can't break or doubt. You have to trust your body and go." "So?" I asked Chris White. "Do you want to try?"
"What? Running down the mountain?"
"More like bouncing." Chris towed the snowpack, then cinched his backpack tight.
"After you."
I yanked in my waist strap and glanced down to check my bootlaces. Strip away conditioning and return to an innate, effortless way of moving that utilizes the entire body, I recalled one parkour disciple urging, the elusive flow state. I jumped into the scree, sliding sideways down the steepest part of the slope until I got my balance and began to run, my feet stutter-stepping faster than my brain could process. I ran right off the edge of a mini cliff, landing in a crouch so deep my butt almost hit the ground, and surged right back into a careening sprint.
"Yes!" Chris was shouting behind me. "It really..."
My feet went out and I crashed, missing the rest. Chapter 36 The Butcher, Day 8 of the Abduction. Cretans, beware. The edge of the German sword will strike down every one of the guilty men and all the bandits and all the henchmen and hirelings of the English. Cretan shepherd to Paddy. "He'd better look out, or we'll capture him too." I rumbled over rocks, sliding out of control, until I was able to brake to a stop with my heels. I was still trying to figure out what happened and how badly banged up I was, when footsteps thundered past close to my head.
You okay?
Chris White shouted as he galloped by.
Yeah, I called. Good, can't stop.
Chris looked like a nervous kid at his first ice rink, with his back all stiff and his arms wide and slightly flappy as he braced for the wipeout he knew was coming. Loosen up, I was about to shout, but decided to keep my mouth shut. I didn't want to distract him. Plus, the guy sprawled in the dirt wasn't really the one to be giving out pointers. And as awkward as Chris seemed to me, it was working. He probably looked just fine to Dr. Schleip, the fascia research specialist who demonstrated human elastic recoil by clipping his keys to a spring and letting them sproing up and down. Your body works the same way. As long as your movement is rhythmic and your center is stacked, head over shoulders, over hips, over knees, as erect as a boxer in the ring or a girl on a pogo stick, you can bounce along indefinitely. But when you break tempo or fall off balance, you short out all that free energy from your rubbery tendons and connective tissue. That's what happened to me. I'd gotten a little fancy pants with my tiny bit of parkour and my Air One jungle training and began adding quick cuts and leaps. I was forcing it. Chris was flowing. He's a marvel, I thought. Then realized I was wrong. He's exactly what I should have expected. Chris is the natural-born hero I've been looking for. The one that Georges Hébert and Teddy Roosevelt and the Heavenly Twins were certain was lurking in all of us. That's why Chris was mastering this stuff while I kept bumbling. I tried to data dump it all into my system over the course of 3 years, but in his own instinctive way, Chris had been absorbing the art of the hero for 6 decades. As with all true heroes, his starting points were compassion and curiosity. He became his own camp half-blood. Instead of searching for instructors in London housing projects and lonely Arizona outposts, he's hiked and sailed and wandered about on his own, getting in over his head and finding a way back out again. His backyard cabin was full of maps and memoirs, making it a window into the minds of the people he was trying to understand. As a psychologist, he listened for a living, and on his adventures, he turned that same encouraging attention on an old farmer telling a story in a language that Chris doesn't speak. And before he knew it, he was being served a tasty dish he'd never heard of, or being led to a cave that no other historian could find. In his own natural way, Chris had become the bond that united Air One and Plutarch, Phil Maffetone and Paddy, Narina Bensel and the Heavenly Twins. Wherever Chris went, he was useful. I was struggling to get there myself. I'd made a lot of right steps. Instead of half-assing around with weights for a strength workout, I now climbed the 25-foot rope I hung from a tree limb in my backyard. I practiced Steve Maxwell's personal invention, the traveling Maxassist, a functional fitness drill that takes 3 minutes and challenges just about every conceivable body movement. I followed Air One and Shirley Darlington's lead and turned many of my afternoon runs into troubled quests. I focused less on speed and distance and more on challenges, like scrambling up hills on all fours, sprinting from tree to tree, rolling under fences and vaulting over guardrails. Useful stuff. But the key, as Chris was demonstrating in his mad contortions down the mountain, was forgetting about everything except the mountain. The reason I crashed, I had to admit, was because I'd been thinking about getting to the bottom first and staying ahead of Chris. I was trying to win, instead of trying to learn. Chris didn't care what he looked like. Much the way Mark Allen only conquered Iron Man after he stopped looking at every workout as a competition and instead submitted to Phil Maffetone's agonizingly slow fat-as-fuel method, Chris had absorbed enough of the heroic ideal to understand that the payoff comes after you stop grabbing for it. Learn the skills, and when the time comes, you'll be ready. Watching him now, as he learned on the fly how to cretin bounce down an alpine descent, was like watching Paddy and Chan Fielding and John Pendlebury in action. Chris was an unqualified man on an improbable mission, and so far he was succeeding brilliantly. He'd gotten us nearly as far as Paddy had gotten himself. And even though we'd started at 8,000 feet, Chris looked like he'd run out of mountain before he ran out of wind. I hustled to my feet before he dropped out of sight. As I began to run, a tiny cluster of rooftops appeared below. The village of Nivatris.
"What are you doing here, boys?"
Andoni Zoidakis exclaimed when Paddy and his band arrived at the bottom of Mount Ida near Nivatris.
"You ought all to be dead."
Andoni touched his fingers to his forehead and belly over and over in the sign of the cross. Then he paused, puzzled. "But why did you ignore my warning? After helping Paddy with the abduction and then killing the general's driver, Andoni had crossed Mount Ida ahead of the band to scout an escape route. What he found was terrifying. Troops were already linked in an unbroken chain and marching up the slope in a total comb-out. Columns of dust were heading toward Mount Ida from all directions with reinforcements, while observation planes were blanketing the southern villages with leaflets offering a choice between cash rewards and blood revenge. Andoni scrawled an urgent message to Paddy and put it in the hands of a runner who knew where the band was hiding. In the darkness of a slit cave, Paddy flicked on his flashlight just long enough to read,
"In God's name, come tonight."
Tonight? Why on earth would Andoni tell them to leave the cave when Germans were all around them? They were in an excellent hideout, deep and dark, with only the thinnest crack of an entrance shrouded by thick brambles. You could pass within inches and never see a thing. And that was exactly what the butcher's men were doing. Outside, shouts and stomping boots were everywhere.
"I personally think that the airplane spotted us on the treeless expanse," Scuttle George would surmise. "The search parties were hunting the valleys inch by inch, firing off flares and bullets too, and shouting, 'Kuiper! Speak up! Don't be afraid!'"
The general grew smug as he heard his troops approaching.
"Perhaps," he told Paddy, "you and your company will soon be my prisoners."
Scuttle George watched Paddy stare the general down. Paddy spoke, slowly and deliberately, and Scuttle George finally saw the leader he'd been counting on.
"You will never escape these men," Paddy told the general. "They're ready to kill you right now. No matter how close your troops get, don't even dream of opening your mouth."
The general went silent. And long after dark, Paddy decided to swallow his doubts and trust Andoni's judgment. Leaving the cave seemed foolish, but Paddy and Manoli had both been struck by how urgent and precise the message had been. Andoni didn't suggest they come at once. He all but promised they were dead if they didn't. As the band crept out of the cave, it began to rain, then sleet. Warily, they felt their way through the dark and icy trees. Somehow, they arrived at Andoni's meeting place, a little clump of oaks with a watering trough cut from a fallen log, but Andoni wasn't there. For 2 hours they shivered in the dark, growing more nervous as the sky lightened. Finally, they couldn't wait anymore. The Cretans led Paddy and Billy down the slope to the edge of Andoni's home village, where they crawled into a gully covered by a thick bed of thyme and myrtle.
Poor Andoni, Paddy thought.
First Tom Dunbabin disappeared, now him. Only a bullet would have stopped Andoni, Paddy knew. Only a bullet, or... Paddy dug out the slip of paper. He and Manoli pulled a coat over their heads to hide the flashlight beam, and with their heads pressed together, they read the message again.
"In God's name, come tonight."
Right. Exactly as they'd... Wait a second. After name, the paper was creased and a little soggy. Paddy spread the note flat, and as he smoothed out the wrinkle, two letters emerged. Ooh. Somehow they'd missed the single most important word in the entire message.
"In God's name, don't come tonight."
Good Lord. Andoni must have seen the troops moving out and realized they were marching shoulder to shoulder straight toward Paddy's cave. He'd implored Paddy to lie low until the Germans passed, but instead the band set